Hey there, Getting in the Loop listeners. Ever wondered what can be done in your industry to help create a more circular economy? To mark the one-year anniversary of the Getting in the Loop podcast, I've put together a short ebook to help you navigate key circular trends in textiles and apparel, ICT and electronics, and packaging. And it includes links to related reports as well as relevant Getting in the Loop podcast episodes. It's yours to receive when you join up to our podcast newsletter at circularsectors.gettinginthelooppodcast.com. So head over to our website to get your copy of the Circular Sectors Navigator. That's again, circularsectors.gettinginthelooppodcast.com. Hi, I'm Katie Whelan, and join me each week as I talk with experts around the globe about circular economy. You'll find out what's being done to make it a reality, and if it can really solve the problems it promises. It's time for Getting in the Loop. Thank you so much for tuning into the Getting in the Loop podcast. Today, Frederik van Duurs joins us on the podcast. Based in Copenhagen, Denmark, Frederik is the CEO of the Green Innovation Group, which has worked with pharmaceutical company Novo Nordisk in a circular innovation challenge. Today, you will learn about this challenge and Frederik's takeaways. I really enjoyed our conversation, and it got me thinking about circular economy in healthcare and how to address consumable products in a circular way. Because Novo Nordisk produces over 500 million insulin pens a year, which are often only used a few times before being disposed. So let's dive into today's podcast and learn what Frederik has to say about the process of working with Novo Nordisk to look into plastic alternatives, take-back solutions, and the possibilities to use enzyme waste to produce new products. Welcome to the Getting in the Loop podcast. I'm really excited to have you here today. And I would just love for you to start off by saying where you're calling from today.
Excellent. I am calling directly from BloxHub, which is a sustainability and innovation, urban innovation hub in the heart of Copenhagen. It's a really interesting place to work. You could say that it's a place that connects all of the people that have an interest in the built environment and an interest in making cities better and more livable. And of course, that fits right into our agenda in Green Innovation Group, where we work to make green business good business. And we do that by advising the major public and private bodies on green innovation and the green transition. So being here at the heart of the city of Copenhagen, in the hub that is sort of the hot spot for sustainable innovation, for circular economy, for the built environment, that's really exciting spot. So I'm glad to be here, and I'm really excited about this podcast. So thank you so much for having me here.
Of course. We met face-to-face the first time at the World Circular Economy Forum last year in 2019. And now just thinking about that, it feels like such a different world, like when we could all meet together in one place. And I'm longing for that.
Yeah, I think the sauna parties of the World Circular Economy Forum in Helsinki, that is something that is quite unimaginable in today's, I'm almost saying day and age, right? And it's just a year ago. That was an amazing conference, really. Shout out to Citra as well for organizing such an amazing event. That was hands down the best conference I've ever been to. It was absolutely amazing. You had 2,500 attendees, and I didn't speak to a single person that did not have a great professional connection and also a personal connection with. So it was just a very, very high quality facilitation and invitation of the individuals that were there, gathered from all over the world, which of course would be completely impossible to do today. But hopefully we will be in a place soon enough where a gathering like that will become possible. But I'd also say that, you know, from that conference alone, I would probably not need to attend many more conferences. You know, if I could just harvest the benefits and the connections from that one conference, then I think, you know, if we actually can do gatherings, physical gatherings of humans into something as efficient as this, then I think that in a relatively short time that could become possible again.
I agree. I think, as you said, it was exceptionally well run. And one of the things that stuck out to me especially was the, I don't know what to call it, but the networking app. I don't know if you used that at all.
Yeah, I did. It worked better than any other app that I've tried at a conference. So that was it was also quite impressive to me. Also, we have done a lot of events organization ourselves, and we've always chosen not to run with an app, and then done a human curated facilitation of introductions instead. Which, I mean, it always works if you have someone making the "Have you met Ted?" intro. Then you know. It just strikes something when it's a human doing it. But I think now in the COVID-19 times, there's a fair chance that we have become even more digitalized as human beings, meaning that I find that when I do introductions on LinkedIn, for instance, between stakeholders that should just really meet and chat with one another, those connections thicken much, much faster than they did a year ago. So you know, I think that there's also some quite obvious advantages in terms of cross-country collaborations and virtual collaboration models that are all part of the transition into a circular economy as well, where we're looking at quite complex systems of actors that need to speak together in different platforms and across boundaries, across businesses, across industries. And we were not as digitally able a year ago as we are today. And I'm not talking about like a slight incremental increase. It's been very impressive to see how the response has actually been and how robust our societies have been compared to, you know, the significance of the blow of not being able to, you know, to have your hospitality industry up and running, to have your retail industry up and running, you know, all of the things that we used to really appreciate in as being part of the human experience or as the work-life experience. A lot of that has been removed. And now, you know, I think one of the tendencies we've been talking about for a very long time is that more and more people become city dwellers. And I think with the digital response after COVID-19, I think that we are actually putting ourselves in a position where we can flip the switch on urbanization on a global level, if we're bold enough. And I think to me that would be quite amazing. You know, if we can rid ourselves of the need to transport ourselves into cities on a, you know, on a daily basis and spend 1.5 hour in transit each per workday, you know. That would just be magical. And when we're talking circularity, it would also mean that, you know, the usage of the buildings that we inhabit as humans would just get way, way, way better, right? You know, since March, I've been working from home for, I think we got back into the office in around June. And, you know, I had entire days where I didn't leave the house at all. You know, I went to my garden and hung out in my garden, and I would, you know, do calls sometimes from the basement, sometimes from the roof, you know, switch things up a little bit, but everyone was in the same position, in the same situation. So normally for something between 6 and 12 hours a day, that asset, that resource would just be empty. And I think that's something that's quite fascinating, that, you know, what if we could design our lives around making the workspace, the physical workspace where we meet together, an option that we opt into, but we actually get the liberty and the freedom to inhabit a home that is a home with a workstation in it. So, you know, we rid ourselves of so many redundancies that we have in society right now. And another thing that has also fascinated me quite a lot is how trusting people are. you know, that we always say in Denmark, that's an economy that's built on trust, that, you know, you can walk up to a prime minister or to the CXO of any major corporation, you can shake that person's hand as a normal citizen. And I think that's quite extraordinary. But I think after seeing what working at home has actually meant for the companies that have been digitally capable of doing it and of executing it, means that, you know, people say that they feel significantly closer to their families. They say they spend, quite obviously, significantly less time in transit, because they don't, you know, it actually can also help us to that transition from having a priority of access to resource rather than ownership of resources, which is to me one of the key sort of switches that we need to flip in order to have a transition into a circular economy. When we can make that switch, when we can have that trust in one another, we're all of a sudden enabling a sharing economy to quite a different degree from where we are today. You know, where people are always like, oh, but you know, if I want to rent out my car for 6 hours when I'm not using it, what about insurance? What about this? What about that? And at the end of the day, I think the insurance industry has shown quite a lot of willingness to actually, take the risk of insuring whatever may come up. I think that has been quite impressive, actually, in the sharing economy innovation. How many insurance firms have just been like, yeah, that's cool, we can insure that. You know, that's one of the places where I would expect more friction in that model, right?
Mm.
At the same time, we also have, you know, all of the clothing stores that are going bankrupt now because they cannot afford the rent, and you know, the clients are not there, the customers are not there. Why do we even have those stores now? When you know, it's an experience to go there, and it should become an experience design journey to actually have a store. Right, because most outlets they don't need it anymore. We've gotten so good at organizing things online, removing the redundancies, making sure that people get exactly what they need when they need it. You know, we're in a time where I think we're approaching a fashion on demand, and we're also approaching a much more tightly knit together platform economy where you can actually buy and sell used goods secondhand. From consumer to consumer, so when we have these C2C platforms and they start gaining traction, you know, it actually means that I think that the clothing store will become a thing that we go to as a tourist activity. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll be a leisure activity and not something you do in order to get, you know, get clothing on your body to you know, not get evicted by the police or getting thrown off the streets because you walk around naked or freeze yourself to death or whatever the reasons why people wear clothes. But you know, I think that there's so many things that we've seen in response to COVID that are actually kind of fortune telling, right? Restaurants, sometimes it can be nice to go out and eat. But most of the time, wouldn't we prefer to be able to build the perfect surroundings for me, to put on my own music, to, you know, set up my own candlelight dinner if that's what I want, you know, to create the atmosphere that I crave, that I need in the room where I want to spend my time. And I think that's something that has been quite removed from the human experience, that, you know, we're probably designed to go out and explore, you know, our brains take quite a lot of joy from that, but I think that to a very high degree we're also designed to be a bit more in one place than what the modern city dweller is, and also be closer to other humans. So you know, I think that there's of course a bit of a paradox in what I'm saying now, but mm-hmm. what I'm thinking is a lot of restaurants and a lot of delivery services have seen huge booms in takeaway, of course, because people cannot go out to eat anymore, so they don't do that. But with a well-run centralized kitchen inside a hub of humans, you can actually deliver very high-end food with a very little degree of loss in the process, and you can distribute it much more efficiently. So I think that it's just utilizing our resources in a much better and smarter way, actually. But of course, it also comes with the risk of driving loneliness. You know, if people cannot have human-to-human interactions, then I think that's one of the risks that I'm seeing. But then I also see that we organize in online communities, and that's a thing. But you know, wouldn't it be magical if we would also start speaking to our neighbors again as a consequence of this?
It's actually gotten me to interact with my neighbors, and I like to credit the current situation, because I don't think we would have been so craving human connection before, that we would have been in our own little bubbles, kind of with blinders on. But then, yeah, we kind of saw each other in the gardens, standing at a distance, talking, and having dinners outside at distance, talking. Because, yeah, as you said, I do think there is like this aspect of individualism and kind of doing your own thing, but we're at the heart of it as well. We'd like to go out, we like to connect with other people. So yeah, it's an interesting time, and also it gives pause to kind of think about what's going to happen. I was actually giving a presentation the other day to some entrepreneurship students, and they were I was presenting something that I had presented usually the year before, the past couple of years. So it was some slides. And before presenting it, I was looking through the slide deck and going, wow, okay, so I wonder how COVID is going to affect some of these trends and kind of instigators for like circular economy. Because there was one slide that was talking about like the trend of urbanization and people moving towards cities. And I thought, okay, well, this, who knows what this is going to do in the next couple of years, like how COVID's going to impact that. And there was also the utilization of resources. And it was talking about how the current economic system is quite wasteful, and what you said in terms of offices sit unoccupied for how many hours a day. And just thinking, well, that has significantly gone up in the last couple of months. It would be interesting. And I think it has also driven a lot of companies to really look at what is essential and how can they maybe take the things that they're using and do it in a much smarter way. Like, do you actually need to have these four physical offices, or would it be sufficient to just have one, for example? And yeah, so those are some interesting questions to think about in the coming years. But I know that I'm kind of going back and forth between the present and the past, but I really think it's important to touch on the challenge that you launched last year, I believe, with Novo, I'm going to maybe pronounce it correctly, Novo Nordisk Innovation.
It's great. Yeah, you did so well.
Excellent.
I think the marketing department would be proud. That's it's a tongue twister. It's a proper Danish tongue twister. So I'd love to talk about that. So Novo Nordisk launched the strategic goal and strategic plan called Circular for Zero. So the goal is to have zero carbon emissions, and the way to get there is to have circular economy thought into every single step and every single process of their entire operation. So for context, you can fact check this and give the facts after, but I believe they're the sixth biggest pharmaceutical company in the world. They are employing some 60,000 people, and they're the biggest producer of insulin, which you use to treat diabetes in the world. One of their key products is an injection pen. Looks like a lot like a ball pen, actually, that you have the drug inside a little glass cartridge. You have a needle so you can poke the skin and enter the vein. And then you have a whole range of different elements inside that pen to enable that I can dose however much insulin I need for my diabetes treatment, and as well as, you know, a spring to make sure that the things go in and out, and you know, a number of different plastics and metals in there. So that product is produced 500 million times per year. I believe it's half a billion units per year, which is a pretty high number, of course. But diabetes is also a massive illness that affects a lot of people. So, you know, in a way, it's something where you have a product that people's lives actually depend on it, meaning that those patients are actually, in a way, you can imagine them being the best possible ambassador for sustainability, right? And they care that, you know, this product that they use to save their life is a necessary evil for them to live. But it means a lot to the patient that, you know, if I throw this away, will it end up in a landfill for the next couple of thousand years, or will it actually turn into something else? And that, of course, poses a number of challenges where you can say, okay, they also have something called like a durable pen, where it lasts for several treatments, and you know, you buy it once and then you keep it for several years. But not everyone can afford that. And there's a bunch of challenges to those models that need to be regulated from central holds. So, you know, in some countries you can get a supplement to finance the medication of your illness, and in other countries you really just can't. And as a pharmaceutical company, there's a lot of rules about how you can market, where you can market, and you know how these things work. So a lot of it comes down to, you know, how the regulation is in each and every market, really, for how these models can work in different countries. But at the end of the day, when you have a product like that, you know, a single-use device, or it's not strictly single, a patient can use it for a couple of times, but then when the drug runs out, you know, it's done. So it's a pre-filled device. When you need to get rid of it, it poses a circular challenge that, you know, of course, removing these half a billion pens from the world would not make any difference in the grander scheme of things. You know, I think that's quite clear that we produce so many items that are distributed and littered all over the place that I actually think that these pens will very seldom end up in the wrong place, mm-hmm. compared to, say, a plastic bag or a sandwich wrapper or a single-use cup or something, right, where people are throwing it around. But, you know, if you're a patient and you carry around a drug, you know, pill blister packs is also not the kind of trash that we find everywhere, right? You know, that's not what they show on the Instagram videos. However, the infrastructure necessary to address this challenge is also the infrastructure that's going to be needed to address the other challenges, mm-hmm. that are probably more pressing. But, you know, I think that's where there's something that, to me, as an innovation greenie, that's just really, really interesting. So essentially, when you have a pen like that, you have a needle that's hazardous, you have a glass that can turn into shrapnel, you also have blood, and you have a drug. And on top of that, you have a whole list of components of different materials. So you know, taking the single-use pen and turning it into something that can be upcycled is an incredibly complex maneuver. Because, you know, from the get-go, to get it out of the fridge of the patient, out of the dustbin of the patient, and somehow circle it back somewhere, that, I mean, that would be a massive challenge. Because you would have to sort it as hazardous waste, and then, you know, or you could get the patients, you know, you could, in a hypothetical scenario, educate them to remove the needle and, you know, do this and that, or send it back or something. But there's just not a really obvious model for how to make it work. So what we were looking at was, you know, what if we could do something where, you know, in the case it ends up in a landfill, that's probably where the majority of the pens wind up. You know, either they're incinerated or they're landfilled. Mm-hmm. If it ends up in a landfill, can we make it out of compostable materials that still live up to FDA standards, mm-hmm. that still live up to, you know, the clinical standards that are needed in the medtech industry? And that was one of the challenges. And then, of course, on a secondary track, we had sort of two tracks in it. The secondary track was, you know, can we find innovations that can help reduce the non-circular materials in the packaging? So for packaging, we're looking at everything from pallet wrapping film over to, you know, the blister packs that the pill comes in, to the cardboard box that the pen comes in, to everything in between, basically. So, you know, it's everything from the pallet that is also carrying any material from a supplier into a storage facility, the boxes that it's in, you know, all of these things. So that was sort of the scope of the challenge, you know, how do we make the products more circular? And then we had an incredibly rewarding process with the Novo Nordisk team in the device R&D department to figure out, you know, what is the actual challenge. And I was quite impressed with how, you know, how much knowledge they had acquired on this topic without having any external pressure, you know, because I think this is one of the places where they've been quite bold in putting out something that is, you know, basically it's only Philips that have something that is, you know, a true lighthouse project in the medtech sector. Mm-hmm. So Philips have defined goals for how big a percentage of their revenues have to be generated from sales of products or services that are circular. And that target, I think, for 2019 was 14%, which they reached, and they've been continuously ambitious on that. So you know, I think for Novo Nordisk to go in and do something like that was, I was quite surprised with how much they knew and how much it meant to all of the employers inside the organization, you know. Mm-hmm.
Do they have targets like Philips, or do they... It's more like they're at the initial stages of investigating.
They've developed the model slightly different. I don't think that it's unrealistic that they could adopt something like that, mm-hmm. but they have defined 13 tracks as part of the Circular for Zero strategy, and I think this is publicly available. Mm-hmm. But I know that the two tracks that we were working with was publicly available. And you know, I know that it's something that takes up a lot of sort of the mental space of some of the brightest minds that we have in this country. So mm-hmm. I'm sure that they're going to find ways to tie it into the business. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they have stated something publicly about it just yet. It's also important to bear in mind that, you know, in the pharma industry, if you say something, it has to be, you know, absolutely right to the dot.
Yeah, because it's a very scientifically driven industry.
And it's everything's very sensitive, right? So, you know, if you make a claim that something is something, then, you know, you cannot say it when you're 99% sure. You know, you have to be all the way certain mm-hmm. that's the way it is.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, and you, or at least you hope so, right? So yeah,
definitely. So the entire challenge was broken down in steps. It started off with us mapping out 350 companies that could bring something to the table in this progress. And then we narrowed that down together with experts from Novo Nordisk into 12 companies that then pitched for senior management. And then the senior management in the device R&D department in Novo Nordisk were selecting the 5 companies that they found could make the biggest difference for them. And then after that, we facilitated together with the partner organization in the program Matter, from Chicago, really really progressive sort of cluster organization operating in the healthcare sector in Chicago. So we basically pulled together our resources. We knew a lot about green innovation, they know a lot about healthcare. So, you know, it was a really good match because we didn't know much about the health tech industry before, and they didn't know much about green innovation. So, you know, joining forces, 2 and 2 became 3, or 2 and 2 became 5, I think. Proper way to go about it. Let's go for bigger numbers. 2 or 2 became 5.
Yeah.
So then after selecting that, we facilitated this innovation challenge where the companies was working quite closely together with the Novo Nordisk subject matter experts on developing prototypes and figuring out how can they approach it. And the results were quite amazing. So I don't know how much of this I can say, but let's say that we went in there with an expectation that there would be one company with a solution that could come to fruition, and we definitely have a reason to believe that it will be significantly more than one.
Oh wow!
Out of the five that end up developing something together with them.
So this was this like a pilot basically, pre-pilot prototyping sort of.
The goal for everything we do is to do something that makes business sense. Mm-hmm. So here. You know, we made it a key focus area to flesh out the budgets for, you know, what would the cost for a stage one pilot be? What would the cost for a stage two pilot be? What would an industrial pilot look like? What would a commercial pilot look like? You know, how, you know, so we have mapped out all of the steps all along. Also, so, you know, there's a chance that the different departments can say this will fit into our budgets, this will definitely not fit into our budgets, this will maybe do it, but we have to change this and that, you know. So I find that when you do corporate startup innovation or corporate SME innovation facilitation, it's really important that you have to keep a razor sharp focus on the business case. Because if you don't see the business case at the end for both parties, then it, you know, it's completely pointless to move through with it.
Mm-hmm.
So that has been a strict focus from the get-go. And I think that's also the key to the success, that corporate innovation programs, too seldom do they have the business activities as the center. You know, so we just need to acknowledge that companies are put in this world to make a profit. And if you cannot justify sustainable innovation within that space, then it's probably not going to happen. And that's, you know, that doesn't make it impossible at all. It actually just means that the projects that we're focusing on have a much higher chance of coming to fruition.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we just need to be better, you know, and that's the thing. We just need to be better. We need to step up our game. And that also goes for the investment scene, that, you know, green investments, they don't have to be a dichotomy to good business. You know, I think green business is very good business. It's just another search criteria that you need to put on top. And then be willing to show much less compromise in terms of that. And then, yeah, I think things are going to even out eventually, but we'll see on how long a timeline it will be. I don't think there's any chance that we're going to make the 2030 targets on a global level, but I do think there's a decent possibility we can make the 2050 targets.
Mm. Yeah, I think the one... When you were first explaining this project, I was really interested in it because a lot of the focus that I've seen so far in circular economy is kind of on durable, like long-lasting goods like electronics or washing machines and computers or medical equipment like MRI machines, for example. And there's this whole other sector, which is like the healthcare. And now we're even seeing it with, you know, masks and different gloves and these types of products. And I think it's interesting to me that poses a really interesting design challenge about how do you make like consumables more circular. So I was curious to hear your thoughts, like any lessons that you're able to share with us about this experience, because as you said, like it is at the end of the day, you know, it has blood in it, it has a drug in it, it's multi parts, many components,
yeah, and it's pointy, you know?
Yeah, exactly. There's a needle.
So many challenges. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, that, you know, we also need to look at what is feasible, you know, and I think one of the best. I've never seen a better way of certifying anything than what they're doing with Cradle to Cradle. That is hands down the best certification I have seen, and I've been looking quite a lot around for different certifications that work. So the concept in Cradle is that everything you take out from nature basically has to come back at the end of the product life cycle. And they have an incredibly strict procedure for how to get that certificate. And that comes down to, you know, you cannot have any toxic chemicals in the product. You cannot have any greenhouse gas emissions from the product. You know, you can do nothing, you know, and it's kind of like the easy thing would be to look at those demands and then go back to sort of the life of a Stone Age person. But I think what it has done and what it has proven is that it is actually also the kind of dogma that we need in order to spur new design ideas and come up with new excellent systems that can beat the old systems, you know, in the business arena, but it can also provide a product that is as good or better. So one case I've been quite impressed about is the KLS Pure Print. It's a Danish company that does printing material where, you know, printing has been a multi-use product, also a single-use product, quite often, you know, with flyers and brochures and all of this. And they were beaten to becoming the first cradle-to-cradle certified company in the world, I think, with a few days from a Swiss company or something like that. that's just gotta, you know, that's gotta be so tough to just see that certificate come in a week after the other one. But anyway, the way and the methodology of doing that is something where I've seen nothing like it nowhere. So that's kind of the highest standard. And, you know, it would be absolutely magical if everyone could make it to that level, you know, of sustainability, of transparency, of integrity. But we just also got to ask ourselves, do we really believe that if everyone and everything in this world wanted us to get there, would we be in the situation we're in today? And unfortunately, I think the answer to that is no, we would not be in that situation we are in today. So it seems naive to believe that everyone wants that.
Yeah.
And then we can say, what is it then we want? Yeah. We want to have economic drivers that are satisfied at different degrees. So when we have a single-use device like that, there's also a lot of practical reasons for doing like that. You know, the cost of production is ultra, ultra low. The cost of extracting the materials, ultra low. We're getting quite good at incinerating most things and turning it into heat and making that into district heat instead. And, you know, there's a market for district heat or heat in, you know, huge parts of the world. And in other parts of the world where heat is in excess, I think we could find a way to convert that heat into something else. So, you know, the question is just, do we need to be that militant about, you know, being absolutely circular, or can we allow for a certain degree of pragmatism in it? And I think that's a place where the healthcare industry is just so interesting to look at, because they have the demand for something that's sterile in a sterile environment, but they also have huge costs associated with everything that a doctor puts her hands on, and then on top of that, everything that they, you know, when you're done using a catheter for someone going into a cardiac arrest, or when you're done using the surgery equipment, when you're done using the Stomy bag, you know, all of these things, it's so complex to clean it. Yeah. It's so complex to turn it into other fractions that can be used again. And I think that's just one of the stages where we really have to ask ourselves, what is even feasible? You know, if we make multi-use equipment and we have to build, you know, a freaking steam engine to cleanse the surgical tools for them to be ready to use again, you know, is that actually better than the single-use model? And, you know, in some cases, it probably is. Mm-hmm. In other cases, it might not be. So, you know, it's not a black and white answer. And I think that's one of the places where, you know, right now we would probably oscillate between, you know, single use is the best in the world, circular is the best in the world. And there's probably a golden middle way somewhere in between, leaning towards more circular, less wasteful. But a lot of what I see that we can do is on the collection side of things. And of course, single-use masks. I mean, I have one in my pocket because it's demanded in Danish public transport that you have a single-use or like a face mask on. And I just haven't gotten around to get to a place where I can buy a multi-use one because I never take the public transportation. I'm always on my bike. But you know, this is just a new type of trash that we will have. But wouldn't it be great if we could just make, you know, that product? I think it would be quite feasible to make cradle to cradle.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, it doesn't really matter if it's collected and composted or if it's collected and incinerated. Either way, it turns into, you know, I don't know, some fairy dust and nothing bad happens to the planet. But I don't think that's feasible to do with a camera that is like rectally inserted for operations, which is why the clinical setting in the hospital is so interesting because you have such a wide range of different devices mm-hmm. that contain all kinds of hazardous waste elements. And oftentimes, you know, a completely bonkers wide range of different materials in terms of polymers and metals. But on top of that, they also have electronics quite often. So, you know, you have single-use materials that are probably amongst the most expensive single-use materials in the world. You know, I think safe for the bazooka or something like that, right? Where it's, you know, a rocket that you use to wage war against someone, that's probably in the range of the most expensive single-use assets that we have on the planet. But besides that, I think medical equipment is probably a close second there.
Yeah.
I just thought about, you know, the reusable missile. That's something I could see split the waters at a conference.
That's a topic for a whole another podcast, Frederick.
Completely different thing. No, but with the medical devices, I think that we have something there where there's actually an incentive and a test environment where, you know, there is the interest to develop a solution. There's also the money to develop a solution, and there's also the infrastructure to get something up and running to do a proof of concept. Where when we're looking at industries with much smaller margins, you know, if we're looking at fashion, for instance, where I don't know how the prices for cloth got as low as they are, even if you factor in child labor and, you know, all the terrible things that happen in the fashion industry, I don't get how it can get that cheap. You know, it's beyond me. I cannot figure it out. And when we're looking at that industry, it's like, you know, when how are you going to, you know, reuse fabrics in a way where it makes economical sense when the margins on each product gets as low as it does,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, it's even H&M haven't figured out to do an infrastructure to recollect used clothing in a good way, because then there's that little thing in the shirt that says how you wash it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then this is made out of a polymer in some way, and this is a cotton material, and then the polymer pollutes the fiber and blah, 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 right? And that, to me, that should be a quite simple challenge. So, you know, just imagine when we start having like surgical equipment.
Yeah, sterile equipment, things like that, yeah.
It's an incredible challenge.
Yeah.
But, you know, There are places that we had never imagined that I think that's where the missile came from, that when we saw the Elon Musk re-landing the rockets, that, you know, that used to be the most bonkers case of a single-use asset, right? You take a rocket and you fire it into space and then you just, you know, leave it in the ocean.
Sayonara.
it's you know, that was, you know, proper bonkers. And you know, I think that there's probably room for figuring out new ways of doing it if we're bold enough and if we have a good business case on it. And that's exactly what they did with SpaceX, right? You know, they said, hey, this can't be right. How do we spend this much money doing something like that when we might as well just reuse it? And that's kind of where the challenge is with all the equipment. You asked about the COVID-19 response and what we've been learning from it. You know, the the flex pen from Novo Nordisk is so cheap that coming up with a feasible alternative that makes business sense is just an amazing challenge.
Yeah.
It's kind of on par with what we're seeing with the fashion industry. Just here, there's actually a margin and an interest to develop new things. So, you know, I think that there's a potential that it will develop. And I think if you came out on the market right now with a completely cradle-to-cradle face mask, it would sell like something that sells a lot. I don't know.
Hotcakes. I don't know. That's what we say in English. Sell hotcakes. Flying off the shelves.
We say in Denmark, it's warm bread.
Okay. Why?
Warm bread, you know, it's like everybody wants it.
Yeah, exactly. That makes a lot more sense. Maybe I always thought hotcakes were like one type of thing, but maybe it's like a hot cake as like warm.
I don't know. I just imagine, you know, maybe back in the days there were lines in front of the bakeries, yeah, you know, right when the cake and the bread came out and we're like, yeah, it's still warm.
I don't know. I'm going to steal the Danish saying from now on though. But I think you touched on a really interesting point in terms of, I like to call it like design for appropriateness. Like it's kind of looking at where does it make sense from a business and also from an environmental like efficiency and effectiveness perspective for you to actually try to collect all of these different things and do good instead of do less harm. So it's like this trade-off between, okay, how do we do it? And I think I'm a designer, so I really like the design perspective of starting with the design and thinking about the scenario and then going from there to actually make the best decision and using that to lead your decision. But you also mentioned electronics, and so I wanted to ask you, because I also want to be respectful of your time. We've been talking for a long time and I know that we could go on forever, but I know that you are a very busy person, so I want to be respectful of the time. And I want to make sure that I ask you the question that I ask all of the Getting in the Loop podcast guests, which is about the In the Loop game that I created, which is a game where every player is a product producing company and you have to travel around the board to make your product. So you need to get materials to make your product. And in the game, there's different events that happen, and these change the market conditions in the game. So sometimes they help players get materials, sometimes they hinder players' ability to get materials, and it really makes players start to think about how could they be reusing their resources and rethinking how they are doing business, basically. And a lot of it hints towards doing business in a more circular way. So my question for you, Fredrik, would be, if you could create an event for the game, what kind of topic or focus do you think you would like to see in the game? Because a lot of times previous guests have linked it to their vision for the future or something like, if this could happen today or in the short term for circular economy, what would really get us moving in the right direction?
That's a great question. I would like to see an event where the people playing this game are the people in charge of the biggest pools of resources that we have. So, you know, to get the investment directors of the pension funds, of the insurance floats, of the sort of heavy hitters of the financial world to get in and play that game. I think that's what I would like the event to be centered about. That's where we. I asked this question the other day. Can we have a green transition fueled by clean money in an inherently dirty economy?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, if you accept the premise of that sort of question, ending up with the dirty economy, there's been a lot of dirt leading up to the point in time where we are, which is what it is. Can we then have clean money? And if yes, how much clean money is there in the world? and how much will it actually need in terms of investment to fuel a green transition? And to me, the answer coming out of that equation is quite simple. It's a clear no. We cannot, which means that we will have to educate the financial muscles of the world into how to flex those muscles for something that is actually creating a habitable planet for all of us, rather than removing the potential for having a habitable planet. So that's why I would do something that includes the decision makers on the, you know, the massive infrastructural investment decisions that are being made, and at large on the investments that are being made, because those are the biggest bodies of capital that are being moved around on a global level.
Exactly. Yeah, with circular business models, a lot of times you see the challenge in terms of making it profitable, or the return on investment being much longer than the normal sort of, so to say, traditional return on investments. And then it's, in the long term, maybe it's better, but in the short term, it doesn't make the shareholders happy. So I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head in terms of trying to rethink how we do things. It has to be done from a systems perspective, and you have to make sure that you're including everyone who's currently part of the system. So, yeah.
And I think a little addition to that is that, I don't believe in the trickle-down effect in the classical sense, but I do believe that money does make the world go round. And, you know, if the big financial institutions say, we have a lot of money for circular infrastructure projects, you know, it would be quite strange if the providers of infrastructure projects then wouldn't start including circular principles in their offers for projects, right?
Yeah. I'm hopeful that this is happening. From some things that I see, it seems like maybe this is coming. Well, let's hope it happens quickly and that it does happen. But thank you so much, Frederick, for coming on the podcast. It has been such a pleasure to hear more about the work that you're doing with the Green Innovation Group and also the Novo Nordisk Innovation Challenge. And I'm excited to maybe see what comes out of it and how it continues to develop. I saw that there was a circular design guideline that was published as part of it. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to share that in the show notes of this.
Of course.
Excellent. But
of course, I'd also be quite happy to set you up with the Novo Nordisk team and have them come in and talk about it. I'm sure they would find that very interesting.
Yeah. Let's see how we can make that happen. And before you go, where can listeners go to learn more about you and the topics that we discussed?
I think the best way is probably to go and add me on LinkedIn. I like to stay connected with like-minded people to both give inspiration, but also to get my own inspiration. So I spend a lot of time on that platform, basically consuming knowledge and articles and sharing what I find the most helpful, linking people up. And usually if there's something that's interesting that we are doing in the company, I will share it there. We of course also have our website, greeninnovationgroup.com, but it's, you know, you can download our reports from there. And then our LinkedIn page, but at the end of the day, we, the individuals in the company, are basically more active than the company page, because we find it to be more real connections that come out of it. So that's something I prioritize quite highly, because I'm in a privileged position where I get to talk to a lot of quite influential people, and you know, if I can be in their feet and talk about sustainability and innovation and the need for a green transition and green business, then I believe my impact will be the highest. So, you know, to me, it's kind of like the reverse Trump tactics. It's just about getting a lot of content about sustainability out there to as many people as possible. I think that's probably something that a lot of us that work with sustainability do wrong is that we become too conscientious of the quality of the output that we have, where, you know, it looks more and more like it becomes a battle of who can yell the highest. So, you know, I spend a lot of my time going out just yelling sustainability in the feeds, and then of course always hoping to provide value with that yell. But it is something where I see that there's a need for us to be bolder in communicating when things are not good enough and how things can be better, and also to be a constant source for inspiration for the professionals that are sitting out in the organization and struggling with how can I actually implement sustainability principles and practices in my work life, in the organization I'm working with. So I'd say LinkedIn is the best channel. That was a very long version, sorry.
No, it's okay, brilliant. I love it. Also, I was like thinking when you were saying the Trump tactics for sustainability, we have the tendency, a lot of us are scientifically minded or come from like a research background, and maybe even, shall I say, like a bit of a perfectionist background, where you kind of want to sit and wait until something's like, oh, it's not quite good enough yet, or I don't have the actual answer, so I'm going to wait until I have the answer. But I think, I don't know, I'm sure you've heard of the lean startup method. So maybe we need more of this like lean startup method with how we do things. It's like, well, we don't have all the answers, but we know something about this, and let's figure it out together.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And, you know, I think it's also, you know, it's a lot about killing the academic inside you, that, you know, the academic is welcome for some problems that you need to solve in your life, but it's really not welcome for other problems. That, I mean, imagine when you had a romantic relationship, if you had to sort of get the same kind of back coverage that you need in an academic argument to just, you know, say what you feel like eating, where it's like, you know, scientific research has shown that right now my gut is telling me that I need to, you know, it's kind of like, you know, sometimes we have to say, we need to do the right thing. And, you know, then just be bold in that statement and follow your integrity and your intuition, because we do need to do better. And you know, if we're talking about 1.5 degrees Celsius rise or 1.489, you know, that's not the center of the argument. That's actually gaslighting what we're really talking about. And I think there's a lot of internal gaslighting in the sustainability community, where people are going like, yeah, but you know, at the end of the day, is this really that sustainable, or is the decimal slightly off? You know, and then it's, you know, we also need to pick our battles.
Yeah.
And go into the places where we actually believe we can have an impact by deploying sustainable businesses that are not damaging the planet and the environment as a whole, and removing something that is, you know. So I think a great case that sort of spurred the inspiration that I talked about before with the clean economy and the dirty money was that Oatly was criticized for having BlackRock as an investor, right? Oatly, the oat milk producer, just raised $200 American dollars. And part of that investment came from an organization that has a leader that is an avid Trump supporter and has a portfolio where two of the companies are directly responsible of deforestation in the Amazon. And then, you know, that becomes a case where people are saying, hey, stop buying Oatly because they have an affiliation with these guys. And you just have to ask yourself, you know, can we not tolerate dirty money in clean businesses? Because, you know, replacing cow milk with a plant-based product, that's green business. And that's significantly reducing greenhouse gas emissions on a liter per liter scale. And I'm not going into whether or not oat milk is a healthy alternative. Yeah. To me, it's way too sweet. You know, I would never drink it. I take my coffee black, and you know, that's just me. But from a greenhouse gas emission standpoint, there's not a shred of doubt that's a much better solution for all of us. And yes, the evil capitalists are going to capitalize on it, but that should not prevent us from celebrating that Oatly actually raised $200 million, in my opinion.
Exactly. And funny enough, BlackRock is also a Ellen MacArthur Foundation global partner.
Exactly.
So I mean, but I think what you highlight, and you raise an interesting aspect there as well, right? So like, for example, if I don't know their intentions here, but you know, let's say they were like, okay, actually we would like to start contributing to more of these types of innovations, then who are we to judge if that's kind of what they're also trying to do? I mean, if you were to have a company that is starting to diversify and realizes that this is the way forward, they need to start somewhere with how they start to change their investments, for example.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I mean, at the end of the day, the most sustainable company in the world are still 14 years ago, they were an oil, coal and gas company. Right. You know, it's so you know, we cannot be we cannot afford to be that adamant about what kind of things we will celebrate or not. And BlackRock invested in Oatly because they are gaining a ton of market shares and it's a growing market. And the food industry, the traditional food industry, is going to be hit with the force of a train that is alternative protein. And it's not ready for it. And it is going to be one of the biggest disruptions we're going to see in this century, is going to be the disruption of the food sector, because it is going to be plant-based.
Yeah.
And the CO2 reductions that we get out of that are absolutely mind-blowing.
Significant.
And I mean, yeah, just, you know, there's so many reasons to go into it. One, it's excellent business. Two, we can make it really, really tasty now.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying this as a vegan or as an avid vegetarian or anything, but I had an Impossible burger yesterday and I swear it tasted completely like a dead cow burger.
It's delicious.
It's delicious. Yes. And you know, that's the only thing that meat actually provides is flavor. Mm-hmm. Everything else is something we can, and flavor we can mimic now, but at which cost? You know, so I'm not even talking about animal cruelty.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even going into the ethics of it. I'm just saying, you know, if we're using 230 calories to produce one calorie for human consumption, I mean, that is so dumb. I cannot wrap my head around it. And it's horrible business. So, you know, that's just what we need to ask ourselves. You know, how many calories will we allow to consume in order to produce how many calories? And I think 230 to 1 is that it's not a good place to be.
I would go out on a limb and say that's maybe bad design.
That could be bad design, yeah. That's it. I will support that notion.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For show notes and links, go to our website at gettinginthelooppodcast.com. And while you're there, subscribe to our mailing list to have new episodes delivered to your inbox every Monday. See you next week.